It's The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. I'm one of the hosts and reporters with NPR's Planet Money podcast, and I'm filling in for Tanzina Vega this week, broadcasting from LA. Since George Floyd was murdered by a white police officer in Minneapolis last summer, the role of racism and bias in policing has been front and center for many Americans. According to reporting from my colleagues at NPR, some of the original police forces in the U.S. were slave patrols that existed to surveil and control enslaved populations. And George Floyd's murder, the aggressive way some law enforcement responded to protests, Black people being killed by police, and the riot at the U.S. Capitol, which former and current off-duty police officers participated in, has all culminated into a push for new laws at the state level. This week, reporting in the New York Times found that lawmakers in a handful of states are trying to propose legislation that would make it easier for police departments to identify and remove officers affiliated with hate groups or extremists. But critics question whether laws like this would encroach on the individual rights of officers. With me now is Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a former police officer. Phil, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Well, it's good to be with you, Sarah.
I am also joined by Janice Lewis-George, council member for Ward 4 in Washington, D.C. Janice, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Phil, as a former officer, how would you describe the culture of policing?
Well, the culture of policing is a very closed society. It's typically learned behavior. You got to keep in mind that we have more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the United States. All policing is local, and yet we do see that there are some core components, core elements of the police subculture, as I call it, or the culture of policing, that are fairly consistent at many, if not all, of these agencies across the country. It's an us versus them mentality. It's an organizational structure that's really built on a warrior mentality at most state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. We have officers who work in quasi-military organizations, and they go out to fight a war on crime, a war on drugs. Warriors typically need to have enemies, to have targets, to have someone that they're going after. So that's really the culture of policing. I think that most people who go into work in law enforcement have good intent. They're good people. And that over time, their views seem to change. They take on some of the values of this culture. And I think what we really need to focus on going forward is figuring out how to change that culture of policing, how to improve policing.
Janice, earlier this year, you introduced the White Supremacy in Policing Prevention Act of 2021 in D.C. Tell us about this legislation and what it could change.
Yeah, so the bill directs the D.C. auditor to conduct an independent investigation on any ties between white supremacists or other hate groups and members of our Metropolitan Police Department that impacts basically the office's ability to enforce the law fairly. So the bill also asked the D.C. auditor to propose reforms to better to detect and prevent such ties in the future.
Phil, I'm curious what you think about something like this proposed by Janice. Do you have any questions for her, or how do you feel about investigating police officers like this?
Well, I think my first question when I look at a lot of the legislation that's been proposed across the country, and by the way, I do think at the state level, and I do consider the District of Columbia to be at the state level for the purposes of these discussions, that's really the appropriate place to have these discussions as opposed to trying to legislate a lot of this at the federal level. But my first question when I look at some of the bills across the country is how do we define a hate organization or an extremist organization? That's one of my concerns.
Janice, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think this was one of the things that came up when I was developing this legislation. And so one of the things we did was we talked to many of our, First Amendment groups. And we were also able to, we met with ACLU and others to sort of define what that would look like. And I think what we came with definition for us in our legislation is a hate group means an organization or social group whose goals, activities, and advocacy are primarily or substantially based on shared hatred, hostility, or violence towards people of one or more other different races, ethnicities, religions, nationalities, genders, and or sexual identities. And so when we developed this definition of hate group, we sort of took it through the gamut of organizations who do this. And then we defined white supremacy as well, you know, and white supremacy meaning a hate group whose shared hatred or hostility or violence towards people, one or more race, ethnicities, national genders, or sexual identities based on belief that white people are innately superior to other races. And then we gave some tenets and may include, you know, one of the following tenets, which white people should have control over people of other races. White people should live by themselves in white-only societies, and white people have their own culture that is superior to other cultures, or white people are genetically superior to other people, were some of the tenets. So, you know, I want to emphasize that my legislation calls for investigating links to hate groups that would prevent any officer from carrying out their duties properly and fairly. So that's also a nexus that has to, that's a standard that's there. And in other words, this is not about political beliefs generally. This is about membership in hate groups that are in clear conflict with the purpose of your job to serve and protect the community.
Phil, what do you think of that definition of a hate group?
I think that's fine. I'm troubled with the idea of punishing for membership or alleged membership in an organization. I think it absolutely makes sense to have restrictions against public expressions of hate, to have inappropriate social media posts. That type of behavior and content cannot be allowed of public employees and certainly not of municipal police officers. So I think my concern goes to just, you know, identifying or targeting people based on alleged membership alone. And I think we're all on the same page. We can't have police officers who are exhibiting public expressions of hate. You know, there are several things that come to mind. One is that in many of the more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the United States, we see officers on a regular basis who exhibit a fear of Black persons in their day-to-day encounters with people, in traffic stops, in talking with people on the street. You know, we've got to figure out a way to change these core values of the police subculture. We've got a way to think a way forward here where we really change what type of people we want to have working as police officers. So I'm all for restricting and holding officers accountable for their public expressions of hate, for their inappropriate social media content. But here's the thing. I think that most agencies, certainly large agencies, including the Metropolitan Police Department in DC, I would assume have policies that already prohibit such things. And yet what we see in policing is that culture eats policy. The problem is the underlying culture. So a lot of this legislation around the country, and I'm not specifically targeting council member George, her bill in the District of Columbia, but we've got to get away from the idea that it's a few bad apples in policing. It's not. These are systemic problems across the country, and we've got to figure out a way, how do we reimagine policing going forward? So I don't have a problem with a lot of this in terms of the proposed legislation and the bills that we're seeing across the country, but we need to be careful that we're really looking forward with our eyes on how do we improve policing.
Yeah. Janice, how are officers who apply to join DC's Metropolitan Police Department currently screened for something like this? Are they looking into problematic comments they've made as part of the screening? Do they poke around for possible affiliations with hate groups or extremist ideologies?
You know, my understanding is they're treated just like every other local government worker, right? And so when you get a job with a local government, DC, we know it best because we have the federal government here too. And many of us have been members of the federal the bureaucracy as well. There's just a standard background check, right? And so individuals just go through a standard background check. They look, have they had prior, you know, contacts with the law? You know, they do the checks like they do, you know, when you enter federal government and DC government at the same time, which is like call some references, say, hey, how long have you known this person? They've been a good person for you. Great. You know, they go through references. So they go through the same process as other DC local government workers. So that's the same, you know, all in all, you know, and what I'm asking for here, and I think this is something that's different, right, is that I think I'm saying we have to up do the scrutiny to a higher level, right? And when I think about this, it's really the same level that we put judges on, right? How many of us have recently been through the whole process where Biden is trying to appoint people to be directors, and that one lady, I can't remember the name, who they went back all through her Twitter and said, look, she can't make it. She's not impartial, right? Judges and appointees are always held to a higher level of integrity and partiality, right? When judges are appointed, you know, Supreme Court, remember back, Supreme Court Kavanaugh, remember back to most recent Supreme Court justices. There's a test of impartiality and fairness that goes into people's family, social, political, financial, and other relationships that may influence judicial conduct or judicial judgment. So I'm saying judges who are the keepers of the law and police officers who are enforcers of the law have to be held to that same level of impartiality, integrity, and scrutiny. And so they shouldn't go through the standard government rigmarole, background check, regular. No, they have to go through the same scrutiny that we send judges through every single day. And that includes social clubs, financial decisions, all of the above.
Phil, obviously, freedom of expression, including which groups you choose to affiliate with, is sacred in the United States. But the fact that officers can carry guns and have the authority to use lethal force on the street, how do you weigh those two things against each other? You know, having the right to be a part of a white supremacist group because it's freedom of expression, but also having real power where you can take your views out on people in some very serious ways.
Well, on the pre-employment level, I agree with everything that Councilmember George said. I think that's a different issue in terms of background investigations, in terms of pre-employment screening. I think it's absolutely appropriate, sure, and imperative that people be weeded out from law enforcement jobs if they have ties to hate organizations, if they have ties to extremist organizations, if their social media demonstrates hateful beliefs. I think that's absolutely appropriate. Nobody has a right to be a police officer. So at the pre-employment level, I think that's absolutely imperative. But here's the problem. In my research, one of the things that I've seen over the last two decades is that on occasion, state and local law enforcement agencies ignore the red flags that are raised. Sometimes they even ignore the recommendations of psychologists not to hire somebody as a sworn law enforcement officer. They hire them anyway. One person that comes to mind, David Brame, who was the police chief in Tacoma, Washington, who killed his estranged wife and then himself in front of their children back in 2003. And in the wake of the Brame murder-suicide, there were several investigations, and they really looked very closely at some of the mistakes that had been made, including recommendations by two psychologists that he not be hired as a police officer many years before he came police chief. So I think we're all on the same page here that we need to improve policing. We've just got to figure out a way, a path forward.
Janice Lewis-George is the council member for Ward 4 in Washington, D.C., and Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a former police officer. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
Last week, hackers breached the computer networks of Colonial Pipeline, which operates the largest gasoline pipeline on the East Coast. The company says that the hack only impacted its business networks, but that they chose to shut down their pipeline control system as well to make sure that hackers couldn't access it. On Wednesday, the company announced that service was starting back up on their pipeline, but they said it would take several more days to get their supply chain in order again. The days-long shutdown has led to slight increases on the price of gas in some states, and it has also scared consumers, leading to overbuying in some parts of the Southeast. It has reportedly resulted in gas shortages for certain areas. But beyond the immediate concerns around fuel safety, cybersecurity experts say this latest breach is a prime example of why both the private and public sectors in the United States need to put more resources into cyber infrastructure. With me now is Chris Painter, the United States' former top cyber diplomat at the State Department from 2011 to 2017 and co-chair of the Ransomware Task Force's recent report, Combating Ransomware. Chris, thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so Colonial Pipeline says that the hack only impacted its business networks. What does that mean?
Well, I think what it means, and we only have what they say to measure this by, is that all their accounting systems, other systems they use, were infiltrated by this ransomware attack. Now, you know, whether there was a connection to the control systems that control the pipeline itself, unclear. And they claimed they shut this down to make sure that that didn't transfer to those systems, which probably was a wise move, but as you say, resulted in pretty wide disruptions.
The hackers claimed that they were only going after money and that it wasn't their intent to shut down the entire pipeline. What was their plan? How were they going to get money out of this?
Well, first, I'm not sure I take the hackers at their word. Second, I think that this is not something that's new. We've been seeing these kinds of ransomware attacks for a few years now, and they've ramped up in severity, impact, and frequency. And they've hit hospitals and healthcare providers during the pandemic over the last year. They've recently had an effect on the D.C. Police Department and interrupting some of its operations. So this is becoming, you know, a real issue, and one where it's not just theft of information, but disruption of organizations. And so, you know, whether they meant to do that or not, that's the effect they had. And that's the effect a lot of these ransomware activities have. And they're essentially holding these companies, these institutions, even state and local governments hostage unless they pay the ransom.
Oh, so they say we're going to lock up your computer network unless you pay this large ransom?
Yeah, and obviously that has an effect on the victim itself, but it has a second order effect, as we've seen here, on public health and safety. When you go after police departments, hospitals, healthcare providers, and critical infrastructure like pipelines, that really brings it home to ordinary people.
And what do we know about who these hackers are?
Well, they're apparently a relatively new group, but these groups merge from one to the other, so who knows how long they've been operating. They apparently are operating from Russia. A number of these groups do. But these groups are all over the world. They're increasing in number. Some of them don't have a lot of sophistication. They use what they call ransomware as a service. They get the tools from someone else and do this. But this is becoming a real problem because it's easy money. There's almost no consequences for these folks. And the amount of ransom they get has gone dramatically up over the last year, sometimes in the hundreds of thousands, sometimes in the millions. And it's essentially free money for them.
Oh, so it's successful. Companies end up paying the large ransoms.
Yeah, look, companies are in the bind where they have their operations essentially shut down. And they're faced with this idea of, do we not pay the ransom or do we pay it and get access to our systems back? Hopefully, it's not guaranteed that these ransomware actors will do that. And so many do pay the ransom. And that just fuels this going forward because the ransomware attackers know that they can get the money.
Do companies in the private sector take cybersecurity seriously enough?
Not nearly enough. I mean, we've certainly improved. I've been involved in cyber and cybersecurity issues for about 30 years now, so for a long time. And I have seen an improvement over that time. But, you know, the financial sector, some of the other sectors, I think, have taken it more seriously. But we're hugely vulnerable to these kinds of attacks. And unless we start treating this as a true national security issue, we're not going to be able to make the progress we need. We're too vulnerable. The impacts are too great. This is only going to increase into the future.
So President Biden has signed an executive order saying that companies that do business with the federal government will need to report cyber breaches and threats. Colonial Pipeline is a private company. What can the federal government do to make sure that critical parts of the private sector that maybe do not do business with the federal government aren't also vulnerable to cyber attacks?
Yeah, look, the executive order, I think, is a good move, but there's only so much that the president can do by executive order, mostly with the U.S. government. And part of that order talks about having better software. When the U.S. buys software, they're going to have standards now, and that will affect maybe the entire marketplace, which will be good. But companies need to, they own their own infrastructure. They need to take better precautions. They need to do a lot better in protecting themselves. The Ransomware Task Force report that I was on that you mentioned makes a sweeping set of recommendations about how we go after this issue. Everything from more awareness and priority at a national and international level, going after safe havens for these criminals, going after cryptocurrency, which many of these criminals use to be paid, but also helping victims prepare and harden their systems so this doesn't happen. But we have a long way to go. And unfortunately, even for critical infrastructure like pipelines, you know, when we leave it in their hands, they just haven't done it so far. They haven't prioritized it. And we need them to do that because the effects, again, are not just on them, but on us.
There's been a decent amount of attention on the vulnerability of power grids to cyber attacks. What other critical infrastructure needs to be secured against future attacks, just quickly?
Basically everything you can think of: water supplies, financial systems, electricity, everything.
All right. Chris Painter is the United States' former top cyber diplomat at the State Department from 2011 to 2017. Chris, thank you so much.
Sure.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
In February 2020, the Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy after facing a growing number of sex abuse lawsuits. And over the course of last year, the bankruptcy case has grown to be one of the biggest and most expensive sexual abuse cases in history. More than 80,000 people have filed claims in this bankruptcy case against the Boy Scouts for sexual abuse. The organization scrambling to resolve this case has proposed different exit strategies to pay the tens of thousands of victims, fearing that if the case is not resolved by the end of the summer, the national nonprofit may have to dissolve. But many survivors are angry at the Boy Scouts' proposals, and they're also angry with the court for blocking out and redacting much of the testimony that's been submitted. Many survivors would like their stories to be made public. Joining us now to help break all of this down is Kara Kelly, investigative reporter with USA Today. Kara, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This case is complicated, so let's begin back in February of last year. What exactly led the Boy Scouts to file bankruptcy?
It is a very complex case, but what led them to this position was really the mounting liability from the sexual abuse allegations. And what has changed over the years, societally, we're kind of viewing things like statutes of limitations differently. And those used to bar people who had experienced specifically child sexual abuse from filing lawsuits or claims later, you know, many years past when they had actually experienced the abuse. We understand now that many people who experience such things as a child may not come forward with it until they're significantly older. I think the average age is around 50 or 55. So many states have been, it's pretty shocking. And you kind of understand why some people really feel that they can't tell anybody at the time, and they're so young that they just keep it within themselves. And it takes a really long time for them to feel comfortable to tell other people. So
can you give us an example of the sexual abuse allegations? I mean, there's 80,000 separate allegations, which is shocking.
Oh, yeah. And they are wide ranging, but at the same time, it's pretty heartbreaking in how similar a lot of them are. The abuse ranges from everything from fondling to rape allegations. And some of it is extremely violent and very, very difficult to hear. You can see that several of these survivors have written letters to the judge in this case detailing what happened to them. And you can read through, those are now on the public docket, but some of the graphic pieces the court has been redacting out. So that's talking about the rape itself or other violent encounters. And so the survivors are, some of them are really upset about that because they want people to know how traumatic this was, what really the impact was on their lives.
Can you tell us how exactly sexual abuse lawsuits end up in a bankruptcy court?
Yes, it's been happening more and more recently. We saw it with the USA Gymnastics case that led them to bankruptcy as well. The Catholic Church, many dioceses have filed for bankruptcy. What has happened is that states have opened these statutes of limitations, or what we call look back windows, where they're allowing people who have experienced child sexual abuse to file lawsuits later in time. And so several of these organizations that have had problems with this for many, many years have been facing lawsuits that they probably didn't think that they were ever going to face because so much time had passed, and it's landing them in really financial hot water. So I think that's what happened here.
Okay, Kara, we have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more. This is The Takeaway. And we're back. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We continue our conversation with Kara Kelly, investigative reporter with USA Today, breaking down the latest in the Boy Scouts bankruptcy case in which tens of thousands of people are filing claims of sexual abuse. Talk to us about the sheer price of this bankruptcy lawsuit. How much money has been spent on this case?
Oh, the price here is staggering. And we saw it too with USA Gymnastics, and in that there was some reporting around the cost of bankruptcy lawyers. But here, so far, I think it was in March where lawyers for the Boy Scouts said that there's already been $100 million spent in this case. They're averaging about $10 million a month. This is largely for attorney's fees, but there are several other professionals that have been hired, real estate experts, other claims experts. There's a lot of professionals who are being paid out, and all of this is coming out of the Boy Scouts estate. And the judge made the point in a hearing that this could be used to pay creditors. And in this case, the overwhelming number of creditors are the survivors themselves.
So the high attorney fees end up affecting how much the victims end up getting.
Potentially, yes.
Kara, it's been over a year since the case was filed. Where do the parties stand in terms of reaching a settlement?
Everyone will need to sort of agree here, at least for the most part, in order for a plan to be approved and for the reorganization to go forward. The Boy Scouts submitted their first plan of reorganization maybe a month or two ago. They amended it, and now the attorneys for the survivors and the group that has been charged with representing the survivors have filed their objections to it. The big objection from the committee that represents the survivors was pretty scathing, and that's what came out a few days ago. And they really feel that they don't have enough information from the plan itself to determine if it's actually a fair deal for them. There's a lot of missing information on the financial status of the national organization itself and a lot of the local councils, and how much the local councils are going to be contributing to a settlement or a trust for the victims.
In this recent proposal, how much money would survivors get if they agree?
So there are going to be a lot of different factors here that haven't been completely worked out. In the first plan, it was going to equate to about 6,000 something if you divided it equally among all of the individuals who have filed claims. Mm-hmm. The Boy Scouts said that they were going to get the local councils to add an additional 100 or 150 million to that plan, but that hasn't actually, they haven't gotten confirmation from the local councils that they're actually going to do that or not. This is kind of more of a wish. So that number would go up, but that's also not accounting for, there will probably be differing rates that the survivors will get based on their specific stories. So the specific abuse that they experienced, there'll be a lot of different factors.
And are any of the survivors pushing for the organization to be done away with as a whole?
It really varies, and I think it's a very personal thing. A lot would like to see it continue because they actually do have some fond memories of it, but some say they need to have significant changes, that the changes they've made in order to protect children have not been enough. Others are ready to, you know, burn it down. It's very different. It varies between person to person.
Kara Kelly is an investigative reporter with USA Today. Kara, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Equality Act is stuck in limbo. Not a single Republican in the Senate has signed on to the Civil Rights Bill, which needs 60 votes to pass. One of the reasons cited by opponents is that the Equality Act would infringe upon religious freedoms. That's long been a common refrain from the Christian right when it comes to LGBTQ issues. But according to recent polling from the Public Religion Research Institute, most people of faith, including Christians, actually support LGBTQ anti-discrimination protections like the Equality Act. About 75% of religious people in the U.S. are in favor of these policies. But media coverage surrounding the Equality Act has often pitted LGBTQ rights versus religious rights. So what explains this rift between some lawmakers and their Christian constituents? Here to discuss all this and more is Reverend Naomi Washington Liephart, the Director for Faith-Based and Interfaith Affairs for the City of Philadelphia and an Adjunct Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova University. Reverend, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sarah. Good to be here.
Also with us is Guthrie Graves Fitzsimmons, a fellow with the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative at the Center for American Progress. Guthrie, glad to have you with us also.
Thanks for having me on and covering this important topic.
Yeah. So Guthrie, let's start by, will you just share a bit about your own experiences as an LGBTQ member growing up in a Christian church? What kinds of messages did you hear from the pulpit?
Sure. Thanks for that question. And I'm fortunate to have grown up in a family and a church, a Methodist church, where I didn't hear any message of condemnation from the pulpit. And then actually in high school and then in college from my campus minister, when I was in the process of coming out, I heard pro-LGBTQ messages from the pulpit and heard about this wonderful movement of Christians who follow Jesus by loving their neighbor and welcoming LGBTQ people. And now my husband is a Presbyterian pastor and we're surrounded by amazing queer Christians. But I realize that that's sort of my own personal bubble that I've grown up in and feel an obligation to do this advocacy and make that the norm.
Reverend Naomi, same question to you.
Yeah, I too grew up in an environment, a religious environment that was conservative, but was not explicit in its anti-LGBTQ stance. So that meant that sexuality, all kinds of sexuality, was off the table. And that's a particular kind of erasure that causes trauma and causes pain. I didn't know that I should be a sexual person. I thought that my body was a problem. I thought that my desires were a problem for my faith. And so while I didn't grow up with virulent homophobia in my religious communities, I did grow up not understanding that my body was indeed a gift from God, and so is my sexuality. It wasn't until I was grown and in seminary that I met out Black LGBTQ plus folks of faith. I started to participate in congregations that were radically inclusive in an explicit way. And then I understood that not only was erasure a problem, but that the silence was a tacit approval or consent to anti-LGBTQ sentiments. So I feel grateful that I didn't have to hear that I was an abomination necessarily while I was growing up. But I understand that it took me a long time to develop and come to myself as a queer person because sexuality just wasn't on the table.
Reverend Naomi, with no Republicans signed on yet, it's unlikely that the Equality Act will move forward. Why do some in the Christian right think that this bill threatens religious freedoms? What's their argument?
Well, you know, I think it comes from a very narrow interpretation of what it means to be faithful, that religious rights, the right to express one's religious belief, one's religious understanding without impunity, is somehow in conflict with these other very, very important civil rights. I think the bottom line is that people don't know any queer folks and have been taught that queerness is itself a sin. And that is fueling much of the political sentiment that is hindering progress, particularly related to this Equality Act. And I think that what we're seeing is a culture shift, right? Even religiously, that many Christian congregations specifically are now radically inclusive. And that means that those congregations, those people of faith are going to have more and more voice, more and more say in what happens in the public square. And the bottom line is that, you know, many folks feel like their power is being undermined, and they don't want that to happen.
Guthrie, you have looked at how religion and LGBTQ plus rights are covered in the media. How are religious rights often pitted against LGBTQ rights in the media?
It's a sad, but I think it's a story that sells well, that there are these God-fearing anti-LGBTQ advocates on one side, versus the secular LGBTQ activists who want to destroy religion. That's a story that sells. But the truth is that there's a growing movement for LGBTQ dignity in this country that includes the majority of people of all religious groups. And that's the story the media should be telling.
Guthrie, does support for LGBTQ plus civil rights shift depending on denomination?
I think there's differences in, you know, every different denomination, and there's polling. But the story overall is that however you break it down, the support is consistent across religious groups, and it's grown just in my own lifetime. And that's something to celebrate as a Christian and for people of all faiths and no faith who value LGBTQ equality.
Reverend Naomi, you've said that the Christian right has weaponized faith against the LGBTQ plus population, and the right has sort of been able to successfully claim religion over the left, at least politically, right?
Well, I mean, I think that depends on how you look at it. I mean, I think that there have always been progressive people of faith, but I think that the more resourced arguments are the ones that get prominence in the national discourse. And so what I'm excited about is that more and more people are coming out, as it were, as supportive and allies and accomplices of the LGBTQ plus communities. And I think that more queer folks are coming out as people of faith. So the monopoly on that political voice is closing, is ending. So I think with more resources, with more platforms, we too can wade into the conversation and have some influence.
Guthrie, this poll showed that most religions actually support the Equality Act, which would add non-discrimination protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Before this poll came out, did you feel like this was the case? Did you feel like you were hearing from more religious people supporting the LGBTQ community than not supporting them?
We have over 120 faith-based organizations now that have endorsed the Equality Act. And there was a petition delivered to Congress that had over 17,000 people of different faiths voicing their support for the Equality Act. And I'm also seeing allies speak out more and more. You know, there's been a lot of commentary about people who have left non-affirming churches. And we see some decline in religious affiliation because of that. And I keep hearing from allies who say they want to be in a church that affirms the dignity of all. And that's been surprising to me in a wonderful way, to see people want to embrace this mission that doesn't even affect them personally, but it may affect a family member or a friend. So they're voicing their solidarity.
Reverend Naomi, it certainly feels like there is a hard line between the religious right and those who support LGBTQ plus protections. Are lawmakers, like all of the Senate Republicans who have not signed on to this civil rights bill, are they just not hearing from all of their religious constituents? Are they hearing from just a vocal minority of Christians? How is there this disconnect?
Yeah, I do think that there's a problem with our ability to project into the public space, those of us who support the Equality Act and any measure that protects LGBTQ plus people. So I think that it behooves our lawmakers to listen fully to their constituencies and not just the same voices that have dominated the conversation so far.
Guthrie, when we think about how the news media has helped perpetuate the idea of religious freedom versus LGBTQ plus rights, is the issue here that this is just an old narrative, that there used to be a pretty clear line, but that now there's more widespread Christian support for LGBTQ issues and the news media just hasn't reflected the changing landscape?
That's certainly part of it. But I think another aspect is that conservative Christians have such a hold and their toxic relationship with former President Trump on the Republican Party, that that's a pretty easy story to tell. But progressive faith is much more diverse and complicated. You have progressive Christians of different denominations. You have people of different faiths. You have a very large and growing unaffiliated religiously community in the United States that also tends to be more progressive. So it's a more complicated question, which I think is a harder story to tell, but it's an important one because the news media does have an obligation to reflect the accurate views of our religious communities in this country. And we put out a study in December from the Center for American Progress that showed anti-LGBTQ religious voices are disproportionately cited by the news media. So I do think it's the onus is on progressive people of faith to voice, to speak up, and on the news media to improve its coverage. And I'm glad you're having this conversation again.
Reverend, what are the consequences of the perceived divide?
Well, I think about for LGBTQ plus people who are seeing this play out in public, more and more of us are experiencing trauma and re-trauma due to these religiously harmful messages. And so I want every queer kid, every trans kid to know that God loves you and that you are indeed a gift to the world, regardless of what's going on politically. I want folks to know that, and that faith should not be used against you. Faith should only be used to welcome you and include you. So we really need to look at the implications for these political debates on the hearts and minds of queer and trans kids everywhere.
Guthrie, to be fair, there is a very real history of harm against the LGBTQ plus community within some Christian communities. I don't want to minimize that.
So many LGBTQ people have good reason to not want anything to do with the church. And we have to honor that harm and why people leave. At the same time, churches are changing. Churches are more fully living out the gospel across this country, in large communities and small communities. People are more fully embracing that love of all. And so that's, both of those things are true. And we can talk about them both and make sure people are aware of how Christianity is changing in a very good and positive way in this regard.
Guthrie Graves Fitzsimmons is a fellow with the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative at the Center for American Progress, and Reverend Naomi Washington Liepart is the Director of Faith-Based and Interfaith Affairs for the City of Philadelphia and an Adjunct Professor of Theology and Religious Studies at Villanova University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Gail Turner from Richmond, Virginia. I'm what you'd call a progressive Episcopalian. I believe God instructed us to love one another, no exceptions. On top of that, doesn't our Constitution promise us equality for all?
I'm Reverend Julia Wright. I serve as a college chaplain in New Concord, Ohio. I fully support the Equality Act and any LGBTQ plus civil rights legislation. I spend nearly half of my pastoral care time counseling students through the trauma of unsupportive families and churches. I believe that as a nation, we need to get over the idea that there's something wrong with our LGBTQ plus siblings and acknowledge that they are, in fact, the beloved children of God.
This is Kate in Eugene, Oregon. I am Roman Catholic, and I believe that we should love one another and see the face of God in all our fellow human beings.
Llewellyn from Quilcene, Washington. I support all civil rights. Any person of faith should. It's ludicrous to think that any child of God, no matter what color, what sexual orientation, should not be treated equally.
I very strongly support the Equality Act, as every one of us, including LGBTQ individuals, should have the exact same civil rights. It is absolutely absurd that we even need to create such legislation. I am endlessly appalled that anyone of faith or otherwise would deny equal rights to anyone in this or any country. We are all exactly the same. We are people. We are human beings. Thank you. This is Mark Mannheimer, from Bradford, Massachusetts.
My name is Sean Tomlinson. I live in Newton, Kansas. To answer your question of whether or not I support the Equality Act for LGBTQ people, I do. I am a practicing mainline Christian Methodist, and I believe that Jesus came for all people. It's not up to us who is equal or not. Everyone is equal in God's eyes, and everyone deserves protection.
Well, that's all we have for you this Thursday. Thanks so much for tuning in this week. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also shoot me a tweet. I'm at Gonzalez Sarah A. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, broadcasting on the West Coast for Tanzina Vega this week. And this is The Takeaway.